A new color-coded map of Sacramento County shows where kids are reading at grade level.
There's nowhere that kids are reading at 95% rate. That's a problem. Nowhere. You can't find that on this map.
Today on Insight, a preview of the project from April Javist, executive director of the Sacramento Library Foundation. A link to this very revealing map is on our website. Award-winning author and journalist Miriam Powell will talk with me about her new book. It traces the history and political dynasty of Governor Brown's family. Then, making fun of bad art. It's the hilarious art critique comedy show Saturday at the Comedy Spot. And then, a walk on Donner Summit this weekend to celebrate the land and the 15th anniversary of Trails and Vistas art hikes. You'll find out what exactly an art hike is. I'm Beth Ruriak. That's today on Insight. From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Beth Ruriak. Is the young student in your life reading at grade level? Chances are no, because about 3 out of 5 kids in the county of Sacramento aren't at grade level. And some years ago, the director of the Sacramento Library Foundation, April Javist, met people from the Campaign for Grade Level Reading, and she learned that literacy could be boosted with more focus on summer reading. Well, that worked. It helped, anyway. But April discovered that there was no coordinated effort on literacy, no consolidation of data, no sense of how big the problem was here. And that's where her quest began, in partnership with the Sacramento Public Library, to map literacy in Sacramento County. The results will be released tomorrow. April gave us a preview.
So at first it was just a kind of locational map for literacy providers to see where they were and where they weren't, so that we could really try to come together and collaborate, because it's a big problem and it's a small literacy support community.
When you say nobody knew where they were or where they weren't, what was that question?
Right. Like, so at a school, like, say, Wilsey Wood, that needs a lot of support, you didn't know if 916 Inc. had a program there, or if Teach for America might have had a teacher there, and was there a chance to collaborate?
There was no one place where everybody was sharing their information or describing who was in what location.
Right. And we didn't really know which schools were struggling and where. We could dig the information out of the school district sites, but we have 12 school districts. So a lot of misconversations there, because there's nothing to take everybody across the transom of the district lines either.
Is the concept of mapping literacy in communities and by schools out there in the country somewhere, or were you trying to come up with something brand new and innovative?
I don't know if anybody's doing this in the country, but I was just trying to figure out a way to create a tool for people to communicate. It's become more than that. Than what I originally thought. But I also wanted to be, I don't know, I know the value of coming together. And we're a tiny organization, but the library is so important, and the Library Foundation has focused on children. So this was a chance for us to really be a platform for everybody, a foundation for reading, and really make the library super accessible.
Help me know some of the scope of what you were undertaking.
So what we decided to do as a group was we decided to measure literacy by public schools. So everything is related to the school and is at the school level on the map. So that means, just to say on the side, we don't have an early childhood map at the moment. But I think there's room to conceive of one and try to find the funding for it in the future. But for right now, we're just at the schools. And what we did first was we took the scores that kids are tested, 3rd, 4th, 5th, all the way up to 12th grade, those scores, and we laid them into this map.
So the reading scores.
The reading scores, the ELA, English Language Arts scores, is what they're called. That's right. And then, so that's the first thing. So that tells you how many kids at each school are at grade level reading and how many kids are not. We made that into a heat map so that we could really just start to see the hot spots. Where are the hot spots in Sacramento? Meaning, where are kids really at the most deficit? Then what we did was we mapped the libraries so that we could see where each of them were. We mapped each of the providers. If Volunteers can use this to get volunteer opportunities. Parents could use this to see about if their school has anything going on that they might not know about.
What's your definition of a provider?
A literacy provider, somebody who is really providing direct literacy support to children. So that's summer reading, that's 916 Inc.'s writing programs, it's Teach for America's teaching program, City Year. They're helping kids stay in school. There's College Track, that's helping St. Hope in particular. There's the SAC Chinese Community Services Center. They've got a lot of reading programs all throughout the South, and their impact is clear, actually. You have United Way, and they're really tackling the Robles School District and working on getting some outcomes there. So those folks who are really focused on literacy.
What you've ended up with in this map of Sacramento County is what?
Well, this is a picture of where kids are reading and where kids are not reading. And it's also a picture of really nowhere are kids reading a lot. There's nowhere that kids are reading at 95% rate. That's a problem. Nowhere. You can't find that on this map. So every school is impacted by this not reading. Everybody has room for improving. And I think that's an important part of the message. And some areas need more help than others.
You're listening to April Javist. She is executive director of the Sacramento Library Foundation. We're talking about a new project called the Sacramento County Community Literacy Map. Let's get into some of the specifics. Go ahead and grab the mouse, and we have the map up in front of you. There is a spectrum of colors and a variety of dots. So what's the code? What am I looking at?
The dots represent a public school. Each dot represents a public school, and it's either a blue dot or a green dot, depending on the layer that you have up. The colors is a heat map that aggregates the information on the per school level and shows us where kids are reading and where they're not. So it's the less kids are reading, the more red the heat map goes. The more kids are reading, the more blue the map goes. So it goes between those two spectrums.
Pick a dot in a red area, and let's go into that. And as you said, there are layers of information that we can get as you change the factors, the filters on the map.
Okay, so I'm going to pick the Dyer Kelly Elementary School. It is the reddest public elementary school in, I think, on the whole map. So I picked that one to talk about. And what I can find out is I can find out how many kids are in that school. There's 445 kids in that school right now, according to that dot. I can find out for you that of those kids, it adds up to 96%, 97% of those kids are not at grade level reading. Mm-hmm. So that's what I can tell you about that school. Mm-hmm. And I guess what I would say anecdotally is that school needs resources. Those kids need some help.
So you can also see by the map what library is nearby?
Yep, I can. I can go right there, and I can see that their closest local library is the Arcade Community Library. That's the library that has a library of things. I can also click onto their summer reading program, and I can enroll through it right there if I click onto it here. And I can find out in that school how many kids participated in summer reading and how many finished the program. However, in this school, it doesn't seem that kids from the school came to the library and participated in summer reading.
Ultimately, that's part of the formula here, isn't it? Linking grade level reading with schools, with library reading, summer reading, and yep. Even to some extent, a meal program or absenteeism in the school.
Another layer, a couple layers that you're referring to that we've also added into this are to show where we can see the free and reduced price meals. We can click on those and to also see where truancy rates are really high. And we can absolutely correlate, and we have statistically significant correlation between the free and reduced price meal and kids not reading. There's also a significant correlation between kids who are not reading and kids who are not in summer reading. And we can see a correlation between kids who are not going to school and kids who are not reading. It's all connected. Reading ends up being an incredible indicator and significantly correlated to all of these major problems.
By contrast, let's look at a school that's in a blue area.
Okay. I'm over here at the Winston Churchill Middle School, and I can see at that school, so that is a light blue, and we can see from there that the nearly met and the not met constitute 32%. So that means that 68% of kids in that school are reading at grade level.
Are they participating in summer reading?
Let me see if they are. They may not be. Let's see. There's menus. So 40 kids completed summer reading at the school, which is 4%. Fairly low percent. You see more kids from elementary schools, fewer kids from middle schools, and even fewer kids from high schools participating in summer reading.
You're listening to April Javist, Executive Director of the Sacramento Library Foundation. We are exploring our way through the new Sacramento County Community Literacy Map, which has mapped schools and libraries and grade level reading or not for students in Sacramento County. This map is just being launched, and there are so many different ways that it can be used, even as there are so many different layers to explore on it. But what's your hope? What's your big picture with the map, April?
Well, the big picture is a good question, and I'm going to click on the layers that get to that, which is policy. How are we going to create policy around literacy? So there has been some talk about maybe starting a literacy commission. I like that. You have to be able to read to participate in our society and our democracy. You just do. It's becoming a mandate.
The very best color on this map is dark blue, right?
Yeah.
And when you look at the picture of Sacramento County, how much of the map is dark blue?
Not much of the map at all is dark blue, Beth. The parts that are, medium blue, because none of the map is actually dark blue, but medium blue, you see in Elk Grove and you see in the Folsom District and then spattered in Sacramento City. But pretty much Sacramento is in some trouble relative to grade level reading. And if you look at the poverty rates, the free and reduced meal program rates, I think people should go to the map and just click that. You'll be stunned. Our kids are poor. Our kids are hungry. More than I thought. Like at least 50% of our kids are in that free and reduced meal program in that intense area. It's a lot of kids to be hungry.
Well, there's a lot here, April. there's a lot here.
We should have enough humanity to stop kids from having to suffer like that. It's not necessary. It's a different time. We don't need to do this. You know, so we should solve this.
You can hear how personal this is for April Javist. The map is a powerful tool that she believes can prompt and guide change. You can find a link to the Sacramento County Literacy Map right now at capradio.org/insight. It takes a little bit of time to play with it and to explore the different filters, but you can find, as we talked through, school data, reading levels, library locations, summer reading information, and so much more. And I'll add that the 5th annual Walk for Literacy, which you can join in on, is Saturday, October 20th. There's a place to register for that as well. You're listening to Insight on CAP Radio. Listening to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. In the spring of 1975, Pat Brown was trying to decide whether to run for re-election as California's Attorney General or to run for governor or maybe be the state's next U.S. Senator. His son Jerry was 19 years old at the time in seminary, and he sent a letter. "Dear Dad, I thought I could write and give you a few of my ideas about your impending decision. The basic question seems to me to boil down to this: where will you have the best opportunity of doing the most for God and country, which two ends are necessarily the same?" The letter then looks toward the bigger role, in Jerry's view, as senator for his dad, afraid that his dad might lose a run for governor. And he finishes, "Love, Jerry. P.S. My advice, make a retreat and ask God's help. You can't do it all alone." Well, as history tells us, Pat decided to run for governor and won, and the family's political history began. The letter is one of many details in a new book by the award-winning author Miriam Powell. She's a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist. She was chosen by the Brown family to write this comprehensive history, and her book is titled The Family Dynasty That Transformed a State and Shaped a Nation, The Browns of California. Miriam will be at the State Library a little later today. I'm glad she's beginning this day with us. Hello and welcome.
Hi, thanks.
That's a much longer introduction than I would usually do, but I thought that letter was such an example of how Pat Brown continuously sought counsel and Jerry Brown continuously shot for something higher and bigger.
It's a great letter, and it's one of many that are thanks to Pat Brown's passion for saving history that we have in the archives. Can I correct you on two little tiny things?
Sure.
You said, not, I think it was just a misstep. You said in the spring of 1975, but it was actually in the spring of 1958 when Jerry was a seminarian and his father was attorney general. The other thing, just to clarify, nobody chose me to write this, actually. I just proposed it. It was my idea. I got interested in listening to the governor talk about his ancestors, the Shuckmans, which he's been talking about a lot in State of the States. And I was trying to figure out what I wanted to write next and just got very interested in that idea of going back and tracing your roots in this family. And so I had a conversation with him and then came up with the idea to do this. And he did cooperate and the family cooperated, but it was in no way their idea or authorized. It was my own initiative.
I'm sure many people proposed this to him, however. So
that's an interesting, I don't know. That's a good question. That would be a question for him. I don't know. It's odd to me that, in fact, so little has been written about the family. I mean, there's one very good biography of Pat Brown by Ethan Rarick, who's right at Berkeley. But, you know, Pat Brown was such a towering figure in this state in his own right in terms of the legacy that he's left in very physical ways. And there's really very little written. There's a lot written about Jerry Brown in the 70s when he was running for president a lot. There was a whole flurry of books. But I don't know that any, you know, there had not been much effort to connect them. And to me, it was a story about California and about history. And really that, you know, again, that sort of the Shuckmans and the pioneer August Shuckman, who arrived in 1852 in Colusa and started this whole saga, it just struck me how it paralleled the history of the state. California becomes a state in 1850. So that was what intrigued me about it.
A remarkable amount happened in the state.
Yes.
Some of the biggest events over the span of these four generations. The book begins with a moment of reflection, mm-hmm. actually in the preface, that seemed to be very powerful to you. And it's a moment with the current Governor Brown.
Mm-hmm. So we're giving away secrets of the book. There's a scene that it begins with the idea of the mansion. And to me, place is very important. And I think to him, place is very important. Obviously, he's very connected to the land, to the, you know, there were natural bookends for me in the idea that August Shuckman came, settled in Colusa on the land where Jerry Brown is building his retirement home. And that sort of was such an arc. So the land is important, and the mansion, the governor's house, was important to me in the sense of anchoring the family and the saga and his decision to live there again the second time after he had quite, you know, famously not lived in the governor's mansion the first time around. So there was a conversation that I had with him there where he reflected on his history in the house and where he lived only briefly when his father was governor, when he was studying for the bar.
I appreciate that you began with the mansion because for me as a reader, it was an easy way in to think, I'm not going to be overwhelmed by trying to read and learn mm-hmm. about this entire history of this massive family, which seems mountainous. Mm-hmm. And in fact, in your research, the extensive interviews, the libraries of material, the books, the letters, the photos, endless stories, and people really, it seemed, opened up because this is a massive journalistic effort.
Yeah. It's sort of a combination journalist-historian. I sort of in the many years since I've left newspapers, have become more of a historian, viewed myself more as a historian in some sense because I spend so much time in archives. And it's so, I try to write so rooted from things that were said and written and done, in contemporaneous history, as opposed to people recalling later, because memory is so tricky. But I think you speak to what was one of the hardest parts about the book, which was figuring out what to write, what not to write. How do you write a story of this family and the state of California, and in a way that is readable, digestible? And so for me, it was a matter of identifying the themes that I think are, I spent a lot of time thinking about and talking to people about what makes California special and different, and how does this family exemplify it?
The roots and the timeline parallel the development of California. It's hard to see whether Pat Brown, for example, was driving that mm-hmm. development quickly, or whether it was happening and he was just trying to ride along with it and make the best decisions that he could with his circle of advisors.
That's a great way of framing it. Probably a little bit of both, not to weasel out of that answer, but I think probably more the latter in some sense. I mean, the phenomenal growth of California post-war, and the war and the post-war years as a real dividing line for the state, because so many people came. I don't remember the numbers, but the numbers of people who were arriving after the war, plus the baby boom, drove this need for schools, for city halls, for roads, for colleges and so forth. And Pat Brown was sort of the perfect person for that era because it fit his spirit. And then not to take away from him in the sense of, he's not a visionary in the same way that his son is a visionary in a lot of ways. But he did, in water, for example, really feel a commitment to the idea that there had to be water in Southern California because the people were going to come regardless and there had to be water for them. So that was a way, I think, in which he did look ahead to the future of the state and play a big role in it.
The timing is so intriguing to read about the water effort that was going on then in light of what we're in the midst of right now. And that happens more than once in the book.
Yeah. I mean, again, because of the themes that are so key to California, water, the environment, the outdoors. I mean, the environment is such a different issue here. It's largely by, I was sort of fascinated to find out what a strong environmentalist Ronald Reagan was as governor, which people don't think of at all. But it was under the Reagan administration that some of the key environmental issues were set up. And that, I think, foreshadows some of the bipartisanship you see now, even on cap and trade and things like that.
You lead us through how Jerry Brown became the central international figure that he is now on climate change. I do want to go back, though, when you talk about themes, how much the development of the UC system and the establishment of higher education, it gave me a different window on where Jerry Brown has been in the last two terms as governor in the debate in the state about UC tuitions and higher education. It was really powerful for this family and in his father's time.
Very powerful for the family. And Pat Brown, who did not go to college but went directly from high school to law school, we talked about my university. His wife, Jerry's mother, who was quite brilliant and was one of the youngest students at UC. I think she was 14 or 15 when she started college at Berkeley, at Cal. That university is a central part of the family. They give a lot of money to it. And, of course, the master plan under Pat Brown is still the governing document and sort of badly in need of being updated, actually. But for me, that was essential. I mean, from the beginning, again, of statehood and the Constitution, the commitment to accessible higher education in California has been a real theme.
Let me tap a couple quick things just before we move on to go way back in time. August Shuckman married a woman named Augusta.
Yes.
That was funny to me.
I know. And then their oldest son was named August.
August. Right? I know that,
yeah,
that whole family.
A bit of a lack of originality there.
You just talked about Cal Berkeley being so important and then Kathleen going to Stanford.
Right.
And the rebel that Kathleen was and some of the trouble that she stirred and then how she kind of morphed and moved into the family tradition over time.
So Kathleen Round is the youngest of the four children of Pat and Bernice and definitely had a different upbringing, really. really because her father was elected governor when she was 13. So she grew up in that world. And she, yes, was determined to go to Stanford and went over the great objections of her father, who thought she should go to Cal like everyone else in the family, and really thrived at Stanford and founded a very exciting environment. And she's also the only one who's lived for significant amounts of time outside of California, although she has come back and is here now.
The women in the Brown family mm-hmm. are important, intriguing yes. characters. And I'm going to add Anne Gust Brown mm-hmm. into that whole category because she really fits with the kind of women that had an important rooting place
Absolutely.
For all the men.
Absolutely. I'm really glad that you saw that out of the book. Jerry's grandmother, Ida Shuckman Brown, who was the youngest daughter of August Shuckman, very powerful figure in the family. A lot of her grandchildren are still around and a lot of people who knew her, and everyone talks about her as being an anchor in the family, very smart, self-educated, you know, comes to San Francisco turn of the century and just sort of absorbs everything in the city. And Bernice Brown, who was, you know, extremely smart and strong. So there, yes, there's a tradition of strong women in that family, and Anne Gust Brown would certainly fit in that pattern.
And I said anchoring the men, but these are women in their own right. And had they lived in a different time,
exactly,
they might have made some different choices, but they were powerful people.
That's another thing that is sort of was fascinating to me. I mean, to sort of look at what the role of women was and how it changed over time. And someone like Bernice Brown, who could have done many, many things. And her oldest daughter, Barbara, who was also quite brilliant and, you know, but grew up in a 1950s world where women got married and had kids, and that's what you did. And so that transition in Kathleen really becomes the first Brown to have, the first woman in the family to have a strong independent career on her own.
You're listening to Miriam Powell. We're talking about her new book, The Browns of California. It traces the family history of Governor Brown's family back to his great-grandfather's arrival in Colusa County. Miriam is the author of The Crusades of Cesar Chavez, a biography. And that book was a finalist for the National Book Critics Circle Award and a winner of the California Book Award. Miriam will be in conversation at the State Library in Sacramento today from 11:30 to 1. I think you're in conversation with Dan Moran, aren't you?
I am, indeed.
There is some interesting Kennedy history here, mm-hmm. and I was fascinated a small conversation that I'll read. Kennedy called the mansion to congratulate Pat Brown, and the two agreed that Nixon was finished. I'll tell you this, you reduced him to the nut house. God, that last farewell speech of his, Kennedy said. I don't see how he can recover. And Pat said, I really think he's psychotic. He's an able man, but he's nuts. And before he hung up, Pat asked the president for a favor. Would you do one thing for me? Just say hello to my son, Jerry, who just came back from Yale Law School and really put me over in San Francisco. And the president greeted Jerry, who assured Kennedy that he would carry California by 10 times as much as you did before. It's a small paragraph, but the interlacing of the family and the time and history in that I find indelible to think about.
Yeah, and there's actually an audio recording of that that's online that people can listen to. The amount, I have to say that the amount of material that is being digitized like more and more every day is just incredible resource for amateur and professional historians.
We talked at the beginning when I referenced that letter about father and son. Mm-hmm. So that father-son relationship comes up in many different ways over time. At first, Pat Brown is all of everything in center stage. And then there's a time when his son, who has taken the political reins, doesn't even invite him on stage.
Right. And very pointedly doesn't. And that's when he, in 1974, when Jerry won the Democratic primary, which was a pretty seriously contested race with against more experienced people. So, I mean, clearly he wanted to separate himself and his identity, but it's an interesting dynamic because, you know, when he first runs for office for the Community College Board in 1969, he runs as Edmund G. Brown Jr., even though, of course, everyone knew him then as they do now as Jerry, but his father had only been out of office for 3 years at that point. He lost in 1966. So, you know, and he comes in first out of 140 candidates because everyone knew the name. Mm-hmm. So he was very aware and very honest and open about the fact that without that name, he probably would not have gotten elected. He would not have gotten elected Secretary of State in 1970. And yet also clearly, you know, wanted to establish his own identity. And in addition to whatever sort of father-son dynamic, they are very different people. They share some very strong core values. But Jerry Brown coming in as governor in 1975 in the post-Watergate era, 36, 37 years old, you know, had very different ideas and so rejects all his father's or 90% of his father's suggestions for appointments. Not necessarily because they're his father's suggestions, but because that is not his crowd. I mean, mm-hmm. he is interested in changing the dynamic and the composition of state government.
There is much here in the history of California and the pathway that you trace that makes it logical that the state right now would oppose so much mm-hmm. of Trump administration policies. And I think that had people been able to read this book, it's kind of plain as day where the state would be.
Yeah, on the key issues, I mean, the one that we haven't talked about yet is immigration and immigrants and how California, you know, from its foundation in the 1800s was a state of immigrants. And that being a core value for the state and also for this family, Ida Brown, Jerry's grandmother, very strong civil rights supporter of or then Negro rights, Pat Brown pushing the fair housing bills and fair employment and really partly losing because on that issue. So there's a very strong strain throughout that family of a commitment. Kathleen Brown, when she ran for governor in 1994 against Pete Wilson. Was the year of Prop 187, of course, and she came out early and very strong against 187 and just said there's no way that I, as a Brown, could support this.
And just in terms of these parallels, Jerry Brown was running for re-election when voters were deciding Prop 13.
Correct.
And that's been hugely significant. I need about 2 hours of your time to get through all of this. One question that intrigued me. Do you see a future Brown politician in the family amongst the many of the younger generation that are there right now who might rise up to the statewide political level?
Hard. I'm, you know, a historian, not a futurist, but I would of Pat Brown's grandchildren, the oldest, Kathleen Kelly, is a judge in San Francisco. She's in the book a bit as well and has been done some really interesting work in juvenile justice in the city of San Francisco and been involved in public office. And there are a couple of teachers in the family also. I don't know. There also was a cousin of Jerry's who was a public defender for a long time in San Francisco. So there's some continuation in the younger years, but not that much.
Did you come away feeling surprised?
Surprised? Like by what?
Well, I would ask you that.
But
you pulled the curtains back on a family in a way that no one has. I feel like you gave us a compilation of so much of what is out there that no one could find in one pathway or going down one historical rabbit hole.
You know, I mean, there were things that surprised me along the way. I try to go into things as open-minded as possible. So it wasn't that I was surprised as much as sort of, I would say, struck by, for example, the importance of the Jesuits and the Jesuit influence on the governor. I found that quite fascinating. Spent a lot of time learning about the Jesuits, talking to people who were in his class at the seminary and that whole strain. And then the other thing I would say is sort of, I think, how California-rooted this family is. I mean, Jerry Brown is friends with people he grew up, who lived on the street where he grew up. You know, the house that he grew up in is still owned by Browns and who've raised, it's that they're on the third generation of raising family there. So there's that connection to the land and to the place that I found to be, you know, quite remarkable and different. I grew up in New York. My friends live all over the place, you know, but there's a sort of a centeredness here that's interesting considering how huge the state is. And sort of, so I'd say that identity of being a Californian and what it means was interesting to me and enlightening.
At about the time of the end of his era, I'd like to have you come back, Miriam, because there are so many stories and there is so much to talk through. And this is just part one of our conversation, okay?
That would be great. I'd love to.
I appreciate the book and I appreciate you being here to talk about it.
Thanks. It was
Thank
a pleasure.
Thank you so much. That is author and journalist Miriam Powell. She will be at the State Library in Sacramento in just a bit. She'll be in conversation with Dan Morain at 11:30. And by the way, since we're talking politics, if you are following the Kavanaugh hearings on Capitol Hill, you can see and hear the coverage of the hearings at capradio.org. You're listening to Insight on Cap Radio. Listening to Insight on Capital Public Radio. I'm Beth Ruriak. Okay, a fun idea for the weekend. The Art Critique Comedy Show, Saturday at the Comedy Spot in Sacramento. The show's co-producers, I think, Jordan Sermonera and Jeremy Telemontis.
How's it going?
Are here. Hi, guys.
Hi. How are you?
So where does this project begin, the Art Critique Comedy Show? Five pieces of what?
Five pieces of thrift store art, art that we find in thrift stores, you know, Goodwill, Salvation Armies. We found them at garage sales, estate sales.
Sometimes we find them on the ground. Some of the greatest and worst art you could ever possibly see.
Have you already chosen the five for this weekend show?
We have. We choose the five pieces of art in advance to any show so that the comedians that we have as guests can also spend some time with them and think about some really thoughtful things to say.
Okay, that explains what happens next. Five pieces of art and who joins you?
We are always on the show. We have three guest comedians, and we all just kind of have our each little segment and make fun of it individually.
I hear this is hilarious. How does this go? Can you give me an example?
So basically the way that the show works is that we put these five pieces of art on display for the audience to take some time with, and they can see them before the show starts, get as close. You know, they can touch the art. They can do whatever they want. This isn't, you know, the MoMA or anything like that. Everybody's free to do what they choose with the art. And then Jeremy and I open up the show and we kind of do a back and forth, one for one roast style of these pieces of arguably terrible art. And then we kind of have each one of our guest comedians come on and they do about a 10-minute set where they make fun of the art. Tell some
10
jokes.
Minutes. They spend 10 minutes making fun of the art?
Some
really?
Some people are better at spending more time on just the art. They'll focus on just the art. We just ask that they spend some time making fun of the art, and then a lot of people will, you know, do jokes.
Sometimes they're so bad, 10 minutes isn't enough.
Yeah.
You know.
Like, Jeremy, look at the T-shirt you're wearing.
Yeah.
So what would you say to make fun of that T-shirt?
Oh, well, he looks exactly like me.
El Borracho, it's the drunkard. It's an example not to be like him. You know, I'm learning my old age. You know, you can't be walking around drunk like that.
Can you describe one of the pieces?
What do we have this month? This month, I think my favorite piece that we have this month is a very large, two large acrylic painting of a very wobbly. It looked like a head that is too large for its body. Boy sitting with a Siamese cat.
Yeah,
I like that one a lot. I think that's good.
And what happens to the art at the end of the show?
At the end of the show?
It goes home with whoever loves it most.
That's right.
We like to auction it off. And so hopefully by the end of the show, people have an emotional connection. They're attached to it. They see the true beauty in it, and they want to take it home.
Okay, this started in 2017 San Francisco, and it's been a hit, right?
Yeah, everything's been going really well. We've found a venue in the city that we regularly perform there on third Fridays, Art Attack SF. It's in the middle of the city at Cash Road Market, and we've regularly sold that venue out for the past at least 6 months.
Wow.
And now we're trying to bring it to other cities, with Sacramento being the first.
Yeah, this is the first time for this weekend at the Comedy Spot, the Art Critique Comedy Show on Saturday. And then the funds from the auction go to?
More art.
More art.
We just put it right back in and then...
Perpetuating our yeah. private collection.
Okay. Whose brainstorm was this in the beginning?
This is both of us, yeah.
Ourselves and a friend of ours, Richard Toomer. He is also a fellow stand-up comedian. I think we were...
It was his last day. He was moving to New York, and we were just kind of sitting around going away or getting ready for him to leave, just making fun of a painting in my house a little. So.
And then we kind of started talking about, like, there's a lot of comedy shows that have catches, and we were kind of mocking the idea of a comedy show with a catch, and we were like, what if we got a bunch of art from thrift stores, and we had a really pretentious critique of it, and we kind of laughed about the idea. And then the next day, I think we all kind of started texting each other, like, "Hey, that was a pretty good idea."
Yeah.
And then I think it
you
took
that
us
thing
about
we were making fun of, and we said it was dumb. We should do that.
Yeah,
we should do that.
And it took us about a year to actually do it,
figure out how to do it. Yeah.
And
now here it is. So, what do people know to join in when they come to the show? Anything? Just show up, have fun.
Come look at the art. Make sure you see the art and take it all in before the show starts.
Form your own opinions, you know?
Yeah, see what you like, what you hate about it, you know?
I think when we first started doing the show, we had a couple pieces on the show that were so bad there was very little to say about them. And we've now kind of refocused to curating art that is arguably good or bad, because there will be a lot of parts of a painting that are technically good, but if you take a step back and look at it as a whole, the composition is pretty terrible, or maybe they were really good at doing hands and not so good at doing faces, you know, or something like that.
There's also a lot of the pieces that we buy, like, obviously there's paintings that are so bad, you're like, well, that's not even funny. That's just a bad painting. It kind of takes that painting that's so bad that you're like, I love this and I need it. I need to take this home. So those are the ones we get, and then round those up and
all
right, put them on
guys.
The show.
Well, good luck. I hope it goes so well that there's a second time, and then you can come back and tell us how well it went.
We would love to come
and where
back
you're
and join
expanding
you.
To.
Yeah.
So that's Jordan Sermonera and Jeremy Telemontis. It is the Art Critique Comedy Show, Saturday, September 8th at the Comedy Spot in Sacramento. We'll post a link for more information. Thanks for stopping by. Good luck with the bad art.
Thank you so much.
And
thank you
a
so
great
much for
auction.
Us.
And glad to have you here today. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Yeah.
You're listening to Insight on CAP Radio. You're listening to Insight on Capital Public Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. At Donner Summit this weekend, you can be part of a hike that features music, dance, poetry, and installation art. It's a 3-mile trail, and this is overall the 15th anniversary of the Trails and Vistas art hikes. In the studio with me is the founder and artistic director of Trails and Vistas, Nancy Tekin Lopez. Hi, Nancy.
Good morning.
And one of the performers on the trail is jazz harpist Motoshi Kosako, who's been with us before. Motoshi, welcome back.
Good morning.
Thanks for making the trip down the valley, and congratulations, Nancy, 15 years. How many people have come out to experience what you do every year?
Well, thousands of people through the years have come out to experience the art hikes. But what's so interesting and unique about this event is it's such a intimate affair that it's only 20 people with a guide that takes you to see these 10 sites along a 3-mile trail. So you have music and dance and poetry and storytelling along the way. But it's not an event that the audience is disconnected from the performer on the stage. You're all one. You're all, you know, sharing this experience together.
In fact, you don't want people to bring cell phones along or other distractions. You really want the intimacy, don't you?
Yeah. And through the years, we really found that, you know, it's an opportunity to leave our little gadgets behind, right, and disconnect from technology and reconnect to community, to your family, to your friends, that you're there, you know, to really experience the day and experience this a magical art, award-winning musicians, but they're placed under the pine trees or the fern trees or on top of a boulder. And so it's really a beautiful experience, a unique experience of taking art into nature.
It's on Donner Summit. It's hosted by
Sierra Club Claire DePan, and it's a nature trail, and it's a new trail. And so it's really a wonderful time for me as the visual artist to go out there and see this trail for the first time. You know, what do I want people to notice? You know, do I want them to notice the bright lichen, you know, on the trees or a stream bed or the beautiful vista point overlooking Sugar Bowl Mountains? And then you look, you know, down below is Van Norden Meadow. So it's really an opportunity as an artist to play with the landscape in that way. And what do I hear? Do I hear bagpipes, or like, do I hear Matoshi on his harp? And so all these different sites really bring the community together. So you start out with 20 strangers and through the storytelling guide, right, you really at the end form like a little tribe, like a family. And so that's what we're trying to create.
Matoshi,
yes.
How is the venue of playing along the trail up in the Sierra?
Well, actually, sometimes it's a challenge to carry this big instrument up to the trail, but it's rewarding. Because I'm trying to match my performance to the beauty of the nature around me. This is challenging because, as you know, the nature is infinitely beautiful. So the art is a human creation. So we are trying to kind of expand our limit as an artist to be able to blend into the nature. So that part is the most exciting part for me.
25 different performers on this 3-mile trail. And Nancy, the hikes start at 9 a.m. on Saturday and Sunday, and the groups leave every 15 minutes?
Yes. And there is a trained guide. And so we have specialty hikes, some family hikes for little, you know, little kids from 4 to, you know, 84 can go on this hike. There are some inclines, and you do start at, you know, over 7,000 feet. So it is a hike. but yes, we have amazing performers, Matoshi on harp, Ian Ethan, double neck guitar, Scarlett Rivera, who's world-renowned violinist that played with Tracy Chapman and Bob Dylan. So it's interesting that some of these musicians and artists like played at Carnegie Hall in New York City, and then here you find them sitting on top of a boulder.
And the fires in the area, have they created any problem with the air for you for the weekend?
Well, through the whole summer, it's been a challenge.
Yeah.
But we hike through almost everything. We've never canceled. So we work with Mother Nature. She's thrown us snow the very first year, thunderstorms. And so, yes, we go ahead and make it happen. And because we have all these amazing artists coming from, you know, different parts of the state, you know, to create this one weekend experience.
There is a Tahoe World Concert, and then on October 6th, there's a collaboration with the Nevada Museum of Art, and then on October 18th and 19th, the Haunted Tour fundraiser. So there are a lot of events coming up, correct?
Oh, yes, yes,
okay.
There is. And so the World Concert is at the Shakespeare Stage at Sand Harbor State Park, overlooking the shores of Lake Tahoe.
Beautiful place. Yeah.
It is just stunning. You watch the sunset on Lake Tahoe, and you have amazing music taking you around the world. So we have, you know, Grammy Award-winning Alexa Morales with her 7-piece Latin band. We also have, you know, Scarlett Rivera and just amazing artists.
And when
up.
Is that concert?
That is also September the 8th.
Okay.
So we're on Donner Summit for the art hikes on September 8th and 9th. And then we're at the concert that evening, September 8th.
So that is founder and artistic director of Trails and Vistas, Nancy Teakin Lopez. And again, Nancy, congratulations on the 15 years. We'll post a link with all information on our website. The art hikes on Donner Summit are this weekend. And Matoshi, since we have you here,
yes,
will you play us out to the end of the hour here?
Sure.
It's such a privilege always to have you in our studio, and have a great time at the art hikes this weekend.
Thank you very much.
How majestic to see that beautiful harp out in the Sierra. That's Insight for today. We're going to close you out with some music. I'm Beth Ruyak. Thanks for joining us. We're back with another live show tomorrow.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.